Good afternoon, everyone. I hope you had a good lunch and are ready to really dig deep into the guts of GStreamer. Our esteemed lecturer today is Jan Schmidt, and he's been working with GStreamer since he discovered it while searching for a way to convert video footage taken at slug meetings. He was once employed by Canon Information Systems doing research into new printer rendering techniques, which makes me wonder why Canon printers are very difficult to get going with Linux. He now works for Fluendo SL, I presume the SL means Proprietary Limited or something like that,
yep.
Where he conducts GStreamer training courses as part of his work. He has extensive software and hardware experience gathered in over 20 years working with computers. He has degrees in computer engineering, computer science from the University of Newcastle. And, of course, he's an esteemed member of SLUG, the Sydney Linux User Group, but doesn't get very many meetings. He finds commuting from Spain, where he now lives, a little awkward. Can I get you to welcome Jan Schmidt?
Thank you. Okay, so originally this was pitched as a GStreamer plugin tutorial, and I was aiming to do quite a lot of plugin development, but that was before I realised the time limit. Normally, we've run these training courses for Fluendo, and they go for a week, and I've got an hour and a half. So I've tried to pick out a bit of useful information to put into an hour and a half. I don't quite know how I'm going to go for time, but we'll see. So, about me, I don't have much more to say because Ashley's covered it very well. I work in Barcelona for Fluendo, and I'm one of the two GStreamer release managers, and one of the main coders. I said I work for Fluendo. Many of you may not know who Fluendo are. We're a company that is primarily built from GStreamer open source project contributors. So from before Fluendo, there was the core group of people working on GStreamer, and Fluendo has been built primarily by bringing in those people one by one. We've got basically the entire core GStreamer team, and then adding on top of that. Business model is built on maintaining open source projects like GStreamer and the FluMotion streaming server, as well and the Aliza set-top box media playing software, with some closed source pieces built on top of that for providing services like properly licensed WMV and MPEG-2 codecs, which have traditionally been a weak point in Linux that while there's plenty of good open source software available for doing those tasks, there are certain scenarios where you can't use them. You need to have the licenses. But to have licensed software, you need to have closed source modules. So we're trying to fill a niche while still providing good open source software that it's all built on top of. And just this week, we've opened our Fluendo web shop where people can go and buy now a properly licensed WMV, WMA, ASF, MMS, MPEG-2 plugins and drop them into their home directory and have those formats available. I'm talking about GStreamer. It's a project that's been around a long time. It started in 1999. It's had a major release about every year since then. It's gone through a lot of API revisions. And it was originally started to address some problems in the community. In particular, at the time, there were on Linux a few projects that were providing monolithic media players. What you have is what you get. The codecs that they've coded into those are the only formats available. To add a new format, you have to recompile your media player. So GStreamer was started to be extensible. It has functionality provided by plugins, and it was always a goal that it should provide support for a completely binary plugin. So the API should be stable enough and well-defined enough that you can build a clean plugin to slot into an existing player without the player needing to know anything about it. To some extent, this has been filled now by other media projects such as Zine and VLC that also provide plugin architectures. So it's less of a problem now, but originally it was monolithic, and that meant that every project that was attempting to do media playback would end up with their own MP3 decoder. So another goal of GStreamer is to provide a library that can be used by the whole class of applications. An application can just link to it to gain the functionality of plugins. Unlike other projects like Zine and VLC and MPlayer, it uses the lesser GPL, the library GPL license, to enable the use of proprietary applications built on top of it and proprietary plugins linked into it, which the GPL prevents. So the same rationale that's used to choose the LGPL for building GNOME libraries. It aims to address the use of inconsistent APIs. Instead of having to code for ULSA, OSS, X11, OS10, Windows APIs, you code for the GStreamer plugins you want to use, and they provide the functionality, which makes media apps very easily portable. And it's never been just a playback engine. It's always been a goal to provide all the processing facilities that you might want and to conceivably provide it for every media processing scenario.
I was about to ask, like you mentioned, you've got like a number of decoder plugins. Is there any plans to provide, or are there places that provide encoders, since it does not just play back?
Right. We also have encoder plugins for some formats, and we're working on others. So, for example, all the FFmpeg encoders are wrapped and available as GStreamer elements. And if you have the right to use those, or you don't care about the legal niceties, then they're perfectly available. You can download those and install them. So GStreamer benefits from abstracting the idea of what a decoder and an encoder and a demuxer are into a concept of elements, nodes in a graph, and pads providing the connections between those. So you set up a flow graph, and that by building the correct graph, you can perform a decoding, encoding, filtering, non-linear editing of input files, etc. So the main parts of GStreamer. We start with elements, bins, pads, and caps. One, an element is a basic unit of functionality. It provides some service. For example, in this one, we have a file source, which reads from a file. We have the libmad-based MP3 decoder. And we have an audio output, the ULSA sync. They go in a bin, which is an object that contains elements. It is an element itself, so you can put bins in bins and build hierarchies in your graph. And they allow a group of elements to be treated as if they are one entity, so you can build up aggregate elements. And in all cases, the top of your hierarchy is a special type of bin called the pipeline that provides management services for the elements that are inside that bin. Next, we have pads, which provide the connection points between elements. Originally, the name's taken from a metaphor for electronics, that you use pads to connect your circuits together. More terminology. We have source pads, which are a source of data. Data is flowing out of that source and flowing into a sink, which defines the direction of data flow from sources, source elements with one source pad down through processing elements to a sink. So because it has a direction, it flows like a river. We use terms like downstream and upstream data flow. And as I said, we call an element that terminates the flow, it has one sink pad, we call that a sink element. And likewise for a source element. So I said GStreamer is plugin based. And the way it works is you have a shared library in a particular path or set of paths on your system, and they provide the functionality of elements and some other classes that a plugin can register. GStreamer maintains a list at the moment as an XML file in the home directory of the user. If you go and have a look in your home directory, you'll probably find that you've got a .gstreamer 10 directory in there.
Yeah, can you just make this one a bit bigger?
And in that, you have a registry file. Which is an XML file describing the plugins that your system has available. Every time you start a GStreamer application, this XML file is loaded. It scans the available plugins. It checks modification times and file sizes to know whether anything's changed, and it refreshes its idea of what's available on your system. So the reason it does it this way is that that you can often have hundreds of plugins. It's easily possible to have well over 100 .so files in your plugin path. And rather than load each of those at runtime, each time you start an application that's using GStreamer, which is slow, maps in a lot of libraries that then can't be unmapped and chews up your RAM, it uses the cache, loads the cache much faster, and then just checks whether anything's changed. And then defers ever loading any library files until you actually request components from those. Because it has the cache, it knows which library file contains which service and can load them as needed. And it's automatically regenerated each time you start a GStreamer application, so you never need to think about it. You just drop a new file in the correct directory and it's automatically available in the applications. The slide mentions the GST inspect tool. I'll give you a look at that. On my system, I've got the GST inspect 0.10 because I'm using 0.10 release of GStreamer. Some systems might also have a 0.8 release, although that's mostly disappeared now. But another benefit of GStreamer is that we've made everything parallel installable, so you can have multiple versions of GStreamer available on the system. You can have applications that use the older 0.8 API, and they sit side by side with newer applications and don't interfere with each other, and then you use the different tools to look at them. GST Inspect is a tool that's used to look at the registry of plugins available on your system. If I do this one, we can see there's a lot of stuff. In total, 122 plugins and 558 features have been registered by the plugins on this system. And if I want to find out about any one of them in particular, such as UlsaSync, then I can provide that name to GST Inspect, and it'll show me more details about what that element does, the author, a rank, which I'll explain later, the file that's providing it, the version number of GStreamer, or the version number of the plugin, as well as the details about where to go to report bugs in this case, hierarchy, and information about the formats that it can process. There's a lot of information in GST Inspect, including the caps, which we saw. I scanned past briefly. It tells us the caps that this element can process. Caps are our way of representing the media type, the data that's descriptions for what's flowing through the graph. So it contains a media type string plus a set of properties that define that data. So it has a text representation which can be parsed. You can move back and forth between a text representation and ask it to build the structure that that represents that format, or vice versa, go back to a text representation for serialization in the registry. So these examples, we've got audio x-raw int, which says that we're dealing with integer audio samples. It has the sample rate and tells us that the sample rate is an integer value. It has a channel count. It has the endianness for that. And it tells us the width and depth, the storage width and the sample depth stored in that.
So that might be things like 24-bit width, but then depth of 32 because it's a 24-bit int stored in a 32, or is it the other way around?
It's the other way around. So it's a 32-bit width for the storage and then 24 bits of depth stored in that.
And can you say whether it's signed or...
And, yeah, you can freely expand. If we look at the UltraSync caps, it includes the signed property on that. So our UltraSync at the moment only supports integer samples because no one's taken the time to extend it to support float. But if ULSA supports float, you can easily add it in and extend this class, and then the graphs will automatically start processing float samples now they know the output can accept it.
Is there a way to express the way that it's, whether it's left justified or right justified, 24 and 32?
Not in the current caps for audio. Caps are a convention we define between plugins. They're freely extensible in the sense that you can add new properties to them, but the actual properties that I use to represent integer audio are merely a convention. So at the moment, our convention doesn't include the things. It's implicit that it's down the bottom end of the word. For video, that's not true. For video, it does define a mask for where the RGB caps are. So. And there's an example of some video caps there, not RGB, but YUV caps. It says that it's being stored as an I-420 frame. It has... This caps is slightly different. It's an unfixed caps, we call it. It defines a range of data types. So this is a description that this element can handle an I-420 frame. It can handle any width from 1 pixel by 1 pixel up to 2 gigapixels, if your machine can address it. And any frame rate from 0 up to int max. And the frame rate's expressed as a fraction with a numerator and a denominator, so you can have NTSC frame rates expressed cleanly as 30,000 over 1,001. That description of an unfixed caps is what you might put on the input of an element, and then when it actually comes time to process a frame, that will be negotiated down to decide what the current format that's going to be processed is. So this is an example, though, of how to represent a range in a caps. You can have ranges, you can have lists of values, and you can have those across all the types. So 4cc, int, doubles, strings are all valid types to use in describing a data format. I mentioned earlier the idea of rank, that the plugin, when you have a look at the GST inspect information, it has this thing called a rank up the top. And the rank is used to describe the preference. For example, when you go to decode a media file, you don't know what the media type is. You don't know anything about any specific media types. All you know is that you sniff the data using GStreamer functions, and it tells you this is MP3. And then you go looking for an MP3 decoder, and the rank is then used to choose which MP3 decoder to handle a format with. So you can have multiple MP3 decoders installed, and the one with the highest rank is the one that will be automatically chosen for processing a data stream. And that it leads into this idea of auto-plugging. So a plugin can provide elements for processing data. Another service they can register is a type finder. And a type finder is used to sniff a data stream and identify what type that is. They have the chance to peek at bytes, try and identify. If they recognize it, they can return a probability to say, I think this is MPEG-2 video with a probability of 75%. And GStreamer will use those type finders, go through, and it'll pick the highest probability data type returned. And it works very well. Occasionally, we get glitches where a file that shouldn't be a particular format is, and we refine the auto-pluggers at that point. So generally, we don't get mistakes. And then there's an element that uses these detected types, and internally it will go and it will instantiate other elements inside itself to actually provide the processing functionality. I've already talked about that. The caps of pads are in the registry, so GST Inspect can find them. And so as soon as we detect what type a particular data stream has, we can use the registry to go and look up which elements should be capable of handling that stream, go and load the appropriate library, instantiate an element, connect it to the graph, and start processing the data. And then we get as far as actually passing data around, and that's done using buffers. A GStreamer buffer is a wrapper around a piece of memory, so it contains a pointer to the actual data that is being passed. It contains a reference to the caps structure that represents the data in that buffer. It has a timestamp, an offset, and some other bits and pieces about whether you should free the memory at the end, that kind of thing, duration. Buffers are reference counted, so you can push out two copies of something without actually copying the memory, and then as they're handled, the reference gets decreased, and it's freed at the end when the reference hits zero.
So all this runs in the same address space?
Yep. It's one process, multiple threads, but one process. You can migrate things between processes as well. So there are elements that provide network syncs and network sources and file descriptors, that kind of stuff. So you can serialize things. And tools like FluMotion, the streaming server, use that to distribute their processing across multiple computer nodes. And as well as buffers, you have sub-buffers, which are an extension of the buffer. They're a subclass of the buffer object and provide for referencing a parent, but referencing only a piece of the memory of the parent. So you can have an incoming chunk from a file, and you can create a sub-buffer that only points to one frame within that and push that out without doing any data copying. We have events move in the data flow as well. They are a message that can be passed in either direction, upstream towards the sources or downstream towards the sinks. They can be either in band with the data, so if you think of the buffers flowing in a pipeline as a chain of cars on a highway, events can be stuck within between a car and they'll move along with the flow and reach elements as they process data buffers, or you can have them out of band so that they fly overhead and get to the destination immediately. And examples of events that we have, you can send a seek request to move to a new position in your data stream. You send a seek event upstream and it gets processed by the elements as they receive it. You can have elements sending a flush downstream to clear out queued data and immediately restart at a new position, for example. We have these things called segments that describe the range of data that's going to be processed, and I'll talk more about those in a minute. And plenty of other event types that are all mentioned in the documentation. And that should say data passing queries. So, queries are used to find out information about media processing in the pipeline. Some examples of those, if you want to find out what the current playback position is, you send a position query, it comes back with a result in a particular format. So you say, what is the current position in time? And it'll say, I'm at 1 second and 10 milliseconds. Or you can say to a file, what's the current playback position in bytes? Duration for the total duration, and a seeking query, which is used to find out things like can you move your playback to a new position. The pipeline may not be able to, if you're streaming video off the web, it may not be a seekable format, so a seeking query will tell you whether or not it's possible to perform a seek and whether it's possible to perform a seek in particular formats, such as, can you seek to a time position or do you have to seek to a byte offset? And then we have the application interface for actually controlling the data flow. So once you've built your graph, you need to tell it when to start processing, when to stop processing. And that's done by setting the state of an element. There are four states. Everything starts off in the null state. No resources allocated, it doesn't have any devices open, you've just got passive objects sitting in memory ready to do something. You set them to the ready state and they should allocate processing memory areas, they should initialize values in those, they should open audio devices, open the file that they've been set to play. And then you move on to the paused state. In the paused state, data actually starts flowing in your pipeline, which sounds a little odd. But normally your pipeline is empty. There's nothing, when you hit the ready state, there's no data being processed. They haven't looked at the buffers yet. So when you set it to paused, what happens is that data starts to flow. It will flow from, say, your file source. It'll flow through your decoder. It'll flow down to the audio sync, and it blocks once it hits the audio sync. And at that point, the pipeline is what we call pre-rolled. So in the paused mode, the pipeline will start to flow until it's primed with data. Because at that point, it's now ready to change to the playing state very quickly. So it prepares to play. And then you change to playing, and your video actually starts moving on the screen, and audio starts coming out your speakers, or data starts getting encoded and delivered to the file.
Can you change the buffer sizes on all those elements of the graph during the after? Only when you construct a graph, or can you do it when you're ready to post?
How do you mean change the buffer sizes? That's not quite true. What the elements do internally is completely up to the elements. I'm giving an example of when you set it to ready, that a decoder might allocate some working area that it knows it will need. It wouldn't normally, for example, allocate frame stores because it hasn't seen the data yet. It doesn't know what the frame size is going to be. But it might allocate a fixed buffer that it knows it will use for parsing incoming data or something like that. So in terms of, I think it's like Og init in terms of libog, that it will go and actually set up a context for that, but not actually process anything yet. But as far as buffer sizes go, it's entirely up to each element to define what is best for its scenario. No. No.
Direct shell has fixed buffers. They have to pre-allocate things to that. Yeah, I'm more familiar with direct shell as well. Yeah.
Okay. I'm not sure what that means in terms of GStreamer.
It's a pain in the ass.
Okay. And GStreamer is heavily threaded, so and everything happens in the background. So you tell a pipeline to start processing data, and it will start background threads for doing that processing and return control to you as quickly as it can. It starts up its own threads, and that means when you tell something to go to the pause to the playing state, that will happen asynchronously. It will return to you, and it'll start opening a network connection, and at some point in the future, it will report that it's actually succeeded. That's in that state change. That's not globally true. There are some simple pipelines where it doesn't need to do a delayed asynchronous state change, but then you'll see that as a return value from the state change request as well. So you can tell the difference between I've already hit the pause state and I'm going and the a different return value for I'll be in paused soon, I'll let you know. And we provide thread safety and suitable locking around all the API functions. So when you modify the graph using API functions, then the appropriate locks are taken. You don't generally have to worry about the fact that things are happening in different threads. There are some caveats, of course. Which leads me to the bus. When you tell a pipeline to go to the paused state or to perform some processing, it's happening in the background. And we have this thing called the bus that's used to send messages back to the application thread. So by using the bus, you can receive messages in your preferred processing thread from background threads, and you don't need to worry about taking locks and things for that. Examples of messages that get sent are the end of stream message when processing is finished. You might get errors if, say, a file is not available that it expected, or a file was corrupted and it couldn't actually do the decoding, you'll get an error. You get tag messages telling you the artist name and the title of an MP3 that you're playing. And you get state change notifications this way as well. So that's how you find out when a pipeline is actually finished reaching the paused state, when it's pre-rolled or when it enters the playing state. The bus automatically marshals the messages to your main thread, and for the main part, you don't have to worry about the threading stuff. Most of our objects are ref-counted. There are a couple of exceptions for very simple objects. But in general, if you call a function and it gives you back an object, that means that you've got a reference to that, and it's your obligation to unreference it when you're done with it. And there's a special case for objects that can have parents, which people who've done GTK programming will know about getting a new widget. It has a special floating reference that applies to keep the object alive until you place it into a container. In our terminology, that means when you create a new element, it has a floating reference, and when you place it in a bin, the bin takes over as the parent of that. So you can generally do create element, add to bin, without needing an extra unreferenced line at the end of that. generally you don't need to worry about it. We have a debugging system that's a set of macros. We sprinkle these macros liberally through our GStreamer code, and they provide for different levels of debugging, error messages, warnings, general logging, debug trace information, and they're directed to specific categories. So if I'm playing an org Vorbis file and I'm having trouble with the Vorbis decoding, I can turn on the Vorbis decoder debug categories and it will start giving me information about what the Vorbis decoder is doing without telling me what the org demuxer is doing or the file source is doing. It's very nicely tunable to target a specific debugging category at a specific debugging level. And those are the categories and levels, the categories at least, not the levels. The categories are registerable, so each element that you create can define its own category or multiple categories. And preferably when elements output this information, they also provide a pointer and use a slightly different macro, and then the debugging info becomes instrumented with information about which instance of an element is producing the output. Plugins can register their own debug categories, and we can use the GST Inspect tool to have a look at all the categories that are available on a particular system. And that will go and load all the plugins and show me all the available debug categories. And again, there's quite a lot of them. So for example, I can run there's a sine wave playing somewhere there, hopefully. I don't know, is my audio working from the laptop?
No time to test.
Okay. I turned up too loud. Nope. Right, so we have a sine wave coming out my audio output. And I can turn on GST debugging for the ELSA sync at level 5, see all messages. Not a very good demo. ALSA sync isn't outputting anything, but its parent classes, base sync and audio sync, are. And so you can see that there's a whole lot of data being output there. The nice thing about the debug system is you can leave these macros in. Our measurements show that they typically impact maybe a tenth of a percent on the performance because the way they're implemented, they skip formatting the print statements and all that kind of stuff unless the particular category is enabled. And they're fairly efficient about checking that. You can turn on everything using a global level. So if I just say that, we'll see all the registry, loading checking plugins, and then start outputting data, and then cleaning up, that stuff. Very verbose. You can provide a list of categories. You can use wildcards, and it works with all GStreamer apps because it's just an environment variable being checked by a library, so you can do this for Totem or Rhythmbox as well. The overheads very low if the categories aren't enabled, but it can be compiled out entirely. So, that's an overview of what's in GStreamer. There are other things, but that's the guts of it. So I'll give some examples of how you would use it. For example, to play an MP3 file. We have this syntax that we call parse launch syntax, where you connect elements together. You use the exclamation mark because it looks like a pipe character and ties into Unix pipes. And in this case, it's creating a file source to read a file. It's setting the location property on that G object piping it through a decoder, pushing that through the audio convert element, which adapts one audio sample format to another, and then finally going out the audio sync. So if I run that, I have a sample MP3 file. We can build the same thing in code using the GST parse launch function. So you can describe pipelines in text and run that text in your code. It'll give you back a pipeline object, and you can just go and execute that. So, to show you an example, got this player application, got a main function. The first thing we do is initialize GStreamer, and it passes in the argc and argv, so this application will have standard GStreamer arguments for inspecting the debug categories and setting them, and as well as selecting plugin paths and things. Then takes a parameter, creates a string based on the file name you provide, and then it calls parse launch and gets back a bin, a GST element. Shows errors, if there are any. Sets the state of that bin to playing. Does a little sleep for 5 seconds while it plays something. And then sets it back to null and stops. Okay. Doesn't support file names with a space in them. Doesn't handle errors because it doesn't have a file called that. Doesn't want to do that. If I rename the file, it should work. And then it'll stop. Not a very interesting example, except insofar as we've created a pipeline in code, played an MP3 in about, 20 lines of code or something. So the next step from that is, instead of using parse launch, you can also build pipelines manually, which is not so useful for a player application because you don't want to have to know what elements you're dealing with. But for more complex examples, when you want to perform particular processing, and you know you want your color space converter, you want a particular encoder, you can create these and construct manual pipelines. So there's an example of that, but rather than walking through that, what I might do is okay, so I'll use meld. Show you the differences between using parse launch and using and constructing it manually. So the first thing is that we're not just going to have a pointer to a bin, we're going to have references to each element in the pipeline. So we need some new variables. One, we create a pipeline manually now using GST pipeline new. We give it a string, which is the name of that element. Each instance of an element is given a name. All the elements inside a bin have to have unique names so that you can refer to them. So you can't create two elements called file source and put them in the same bin. You'd have to have file source 1 and file source 2. And in this example, it's manually specifying all the names as it creates elements, but you can also specify null, and GStreamer will pick a magic name like filesource 0, filesource 1. We create the filesource using GST element factory make, which is your top level interaction with the registry. You tell it, I want an instance of the element named filesource, and it will go and look it up in the registry, find out which file that's in, load the plugin, instantiate the element, and return you a floating reference to it. So we get our filesource. We check that it actually returned. You'll just get back null if you ask for something that doesn't exist. We use gobject set to set the location property. Is there anyone that doesn't know enough about gobject to know what properties are? How many people have used gobject and glib before? Sorry, maybe I should ask how many people haven't. Okay, so there's still a third or so. Okay, so gobject is a GNOME library. It's built on top of glib, and it provides an object orientation framework like C++ provides you classes. Gobject provides a similar service with a lot more verbosity in C code. So you can create a gobject, you can derive new gobjects from existing ones, you get a hierarchy with single inheritance, and as a side effect you get features like properties on the objects. Wow. Okay. You can see the properties using GST inspect as well. So if I GST inspect the file source, down the bottom it's telling me the properties of that. One is the name of the object. Two is the block size that it's going to output. And maybe that's what you meant about pre-allocating buffers, I'm not sure. That's the read size. Each chunk of the file in this case is going to be 4K, 4096 bytes. We have the location, which we can set on the you can't set it on the fly, but you can set it by returning the element to the ready state, setting a new file, and then moving back up, and it'll change to a new file. You can read out the file descriptor directly if you need to use it for something else, etc. So in this case, we're setting the location property. Next, we create MAD, create an audio convert, create null sysinc. We add all those to the bin that we created using GST bin add many, which you terminate with a null. You always have to put a null on the end to terminate the argument list. Otherwise, you'll get weird bugs. And then it does GST element link many and links those elements together. Does anyone not follow that? Good. And then the rest of it's the same. We set it playing, wait 5 seconds, and then go back to sleep. 5 minute break in 5 to 10 minutes, no worries. So build the elements manually and connect them. If I go into example 3, run make, run the player. So this player has the problem that it only plays for 5 seconds. Really, you want to play until the end of stream, and then you want to change the file, for example. So we need to listen on the bus for incoming messages for that, because that's how our pipelines inform us that they've hit end of stream. I'll use meld again and show you I'm adding this event loop at the top that's going to handle the messages. And then down the bottom, instead of sleeping for 5 seconds, it's going to run the event loop. So the bottom bit's not so interesting, it's the top bit that is. So let's have a look at what the event loop's doing. One, we pass in the pipeline, the top level element of our graph. Two, we get a reference to the bus using GST element get bus. Then we run an infinite loop polling the bus for messages. And that will block the parameters we're passing there. We're passing the bus that we're getting a message from. We're passing an enumeration that tells us tells it what kind of messages we're interested in. So we can say EOS messages or state changes, or in this case we can say any. It's a bit mask. And a timeout, and minus one means wait forever until there's a message available. Then we handle the type of the message, and if it's an EOS, we exit our method. So if you have a glib main loop, you can there's a method on the bus. You say, put yourself in the main loop, and it will give you a call back using.
They will get marshaled as glib signals then.
Oh,
yep.
Okay. So it's integrated with the glib main loop.
Yeah.
So you don't have to use glib if you're a simple application like this.
Yep. I think we don't have the code in GStreamer itself, but I've also heard reports of people integrating it with Qt's main loop. A similar way and getting a slot callback. And then we handle a warning or an error message. So now if I run the application and I tell it, it's going to give me an error and it will actually fail. So if I've given it the file name with a space in now, and because it's not reading the file name out of the environment variables correctly, it would try and load the wrong file. It would now handle the error instead of pretending to play anyway. And I can leave it. Now it's going to go to the end of the file. Like I need to.
You get a shiver in the dark.
That's true. I am supposed to take a 5-minute break. Anyway, it's already played longer than 5 seconds, right? It's going to go to the end of the file. Should we take the break now? Okay. So 5-minute break. 4-5. Yeah, 5-minute break. Right. Change the tapes.
We're finished. Jean is trying to finish the session.
29 slides out of 54 with half an hour to go. Yep, talk faster. Okay, so example 5. I showed you playing an audio file. A more interesting example is playing audio and video together. But to know how to do that, you need to know about dynamic pads. So far what we've seen are elements with static pads. They're always present when you create a MAD decoder. It always has a sync pad and a source pad. But to play a muxed file, you need to handle detection of streams on the fly. So you open up a file, you detect that it's an OGG file, but that doesn't tell you whether it's an OGG file with one Vorbis stream, two Vorbis streams, Vorbis and Theora, Vorbis and Theora and an OGM stream. You have to connect it to the OGG demuxer in order to find that out. And what will happen is that the OGG demuxer will create pads on the fly as it discovers each data stream in the file. And that also means that you now, instead of statically setting up your pipeline, you have to respond on the fly and create new elements, put them into the graph and not miss a beat. So I'll show you example 5. Again, I'll show you in meld again in terms of what changes happen. So the changes in this case are a little bit more extensive. I've got a big, you can see down the side in meld, shows you where the changes in the file are. I've got a big chunk of new code at the top. But I'll start at the bottom and show you those changes. 1, we're not creating our decoder, converter, and output anymore. Instead, we're creating a file source, and we're going to connect it to a demuxer. So I've got just a bin, a file, and a demuxer. And we're going to hard code OGG demux. We're going to play an OGG file. So we create the demuxer, we put it into the bin, link it to the file source, And now we connect to the pad added signal on the demuxer. Signals are a G object callback, and when this event of a new pad happens, our callback, our new pad callback, will be called, and it'll be passed our bin as an argument. And then we set it to playing. So that's all the main loop does. And all the interesting stuff happens in the new pad callback. Ah, yeah, our event handler's a little bit different. It was pointed out to me in the break that the event handler in the previous example is actually wrong, because it extracts a bus from the element, but it doesn't unref it when it returns. So it leaks a reference to the bus, which means it's leaking memory. So there are those two new lines in there in the return paths for making sure to unref the bus first. If you leak a bus, you likely leak messages that are left on the bus. If you leak messages that are left on the bus, you likely leak references to the elements that sent them. If you leak references to the elements, then you likely leak gobs of memory. Ref counting is very important. And it's a good reason for using a high-level language like Python, so you don't have to worry about it. Okay, so the important stuff happens in our new pad callback, which is here. I think I have some slides describing this a little bit. So what we're going to create is a file source, a demuxer, and then as the pads come out of the demuxer, we'll be creating a video playback section and an audio playback section. And they'll be implemented as bins. I mentioned you can put elements into a bin, then you can put bins inside bins, and you can end up creating these aggregate elements. In this case, our video bin with a thing called a ghost pad will contain a queue, which is a buffer for temporary storage of data in the flow. It'll contain the decoder for decoding out the Aura video. It'll contain a color space conversion, and it'll contain a video sync. So what happens here is the queue is going to provide a small amount of buffering to account for the offset in demuxing two streams. So normally you get audio, say, a fraction of a second ahead of the video, and you need to compensate for that offset, and the queue provides the buffering that does that. You always need a queue after a demuxer to handle the fact that there's multiple flows coming out of it. The decoder is obvious. The color space acts as an adapter. Fiora will be producing I-420 video frames. Our video sync, I forget which one I used, but probably our video sync will be normal X output, which might only handle RGB. So in that case, the color space conversion element will detect I have incoming I-420 data. My peer on the other side can only do RGB, so I need to do a conversion, and it will set itself up to do the appropriate color conversion, process the frames, and what comes out the other side will be changed. Or it will detect that the peer accepts I-420 frames, it'll set itself up for pass-through and no processing happens. There's the thing called the ghost pad. So the queue has a sync pad, and we use this thing called a ghost pad to make that appear as if it's a pad on the parent bin. So now we have a bin that accepts incoming Fiora data and magically makes it display on in an X window, and it just acts as one element. We're not up to that yet. Okay, so in our new pad handler, what's going to happen is we'll take a look at which pad has been created, and then we create the appropriate output bin and connect it into the graph. So, one, our functions are the element that's adding the pad that's being added, and in this case, the pipeline. The piece of data that we added when we registered the callback is also passed in as the third parameter, which provides our context. We go look at the pad, we get the caps, which are going to tell us the format. We do some stuff on the caps, which we extract the structure, which is a property bag for all the values that are stored in this caps. We get the name, which is the video ex Theora part, or audio ex Vorbis. And we know that these are the types because if I use GST inspect on our, oh no, Octimux is a bad example. All right, let's say that we did it by trial and error. We know that Octimux is going to produce something called video ex Theora and audio ex Vorbis just by prior knowledge. Later we don't need that information, but for now, because we're manually constructing a pipeline specifically for Og Vorbis, we do. So we're going to look at the stream type, which comes off the name of the structure. The structure comes off the caps. And if it's Theora, we call the create Theora decode function, otherwise we create the Vorbis decoder. They return an element constructed the same way as our previous example. It creates a few elements, puts them in a bin, and then adds a ghost pad on the bin after and links them together. So we get back an element, and we add it into the pipeline. We get the sync pad on the bin, link it to the new pad that's just been given to us from the decoder, unreference some stuff, and finally we set our new decoders to the same state, to the playing state, because the rest of our stuff's already in playing. We've created a new element. It starts off in null. We put it in the pipeline, and then we set its state, and it's now participating in the pipeline. The actual create Theora and create Vorbis functions aren't that interesting. They look identical to our main code before. We create a bin, create some elements, add them to the bin, link them together. And the only bit that we haven't seen before is the fact that we now get the sync pad off the queue and we add a new pad to the bin as a ghost pad of that sync to act as a proxy for delivering data. So any data that arrives on this pad gets delivered to the internal sync pad. The question is, how is that different to just connecting a normal sync and source pad together? The difference is that our ghost pad acts as a proxy for an internal pad. So externally, it our bin just looks like one element that has a pad. And external viewers don't need to know that this is actually implemented by proxying it directly into an internal element. So it purely acts as a patch connect that makes this sync pad look like that sync pad. Any operations on the ghost pad are done directly on the child.
Just one thing that wasn't clear there. You've got a queue now to pull out for the deleted audio and video.
Yep.
How do you then synchronise up two streams on the pipeline at the end?
Okay. That comes a little bit later.
Okay.
If I can get there. So that's example 5. I run that. Starting to be a really, starting to not be that interesting because you've seen me play stuff before, but we get our callbacks. Theora and Vorbis connect the decoders and now we play video and audio, and they are automatic. In general, the synchronization happens automatically. Example 6. This is the part where I said you need to know that the demuxer is going to produce these particular types on the caps. But we have an element called decode bin that takes care of all this logic for you. It saves you effort in creating these kinds of playback streams. So what decode bin will do is you give it a stream. It will use typefind functions to detect the type of that stream, and it will automatically connect demuxers and decoders in chains internally and instantiating queues as needed until it produces raw video and raw audio on the output. So it will either decode all the way down to raw video frames and raw audio, or it will give you an error message if it doesn't have the decoders to do it, or if it can't detect the type, for example. So now our player will look like file source into a decode bin, into a video bin. It acts like a magic demuxer. The difference is that in our video bin, we get rid of the decoder. It's going to be handled by decode bin now. We still have a queue to provide a little bit of buffering, which will help with evening out uneven CPU usage in a decoder, for example. But our queue is going to be tiny. It'll be a tenth of a second or something. Just one or two frames of buffering. And so now instead of creating a Theora decoder, we're just creating a video output. The difference is it doesn't have a decoder in it anymore. We set the queue time, we set the buffering time to a tenth of a second, and we set. So a queue provides buffering in formats. It can buffer a certain amount of time, it can buffer a certain number of bytes, or it can buffer a certain number of buffers. And it acts as a FIFO. In this case, because we have raw audio and raw video, they have timestamps, we can say a tenth of a second end-to-end. And then a queue will allow a decoder to queue up one-tenth of a second, and if it tries to push any more than that, the decoder gets blocked, and the queue is pushing stuff out in a different thread. So by putting a queue in there, a queue acts as a thread decoupling boundary as well. It'll have an input thread on one side, it'll be pushing data on the output in a different thread.
And so if you set more than one of those maximums, does it enforce all the constraints?
Yeah. The minimum of those. Otherwise the same, FFmpeg color space into the sync. Audio output's the same, we got rid of the decoder and we've set a small time-based buffer. Down in the main loop, things are a little bit different again. Instead of creating our old demuxer, we're creating a decode bin. And instead of connecting to the pad added, we're connecting to the decode bin specific new decoded pad callback. Slightly different mechanism. You only use new decoded pad with decode bin. All other elements you'll use new pad, or pad added rather. You can see those again in GST inspect. If I do a GST inspect on decode bin, because it's just another element, it's in the registry. We can have a look at the properties of it. We can have a look at, it's got a sync pad and a template for source pads. It has a whole bunch of details and it has one property, its name, and it has some signals for providing the callbacks. And you can see that new decoded pad takes an argument of an element. It takes a callback that will take arguments of the element, decode bin. The pad that's been added, a jiboolean that's not explained, but is explained if you go look at the documentation for this element. And our user data pointer, which all the callbacks provide as a context pointer. So we create decode bin, we listen on new decoded pad, and then when that gets called, we get the caps, we get the structure, we look at the name. And the difference is now, instead of matching on Theora or Vorbis, we're matching on video/xraw or audio/xraw, which I showed you in the examples of caps before, that can be video xraw YUV, it can be video xraw RGB, this will match both. It can be audio xraw int or xraw float. And then we create our output bins and we play. Now we can go into example 6, make it, it'll play our file. It doesn't do the synchronization right now, I forget why. But the difference is now, because we're using decode bin, I can also play the same file as an MPEG. And now I'm playing it. I can play, what else we got? MP3. Play an audio, it just detects the audio now. It doesn't detect video, so it won't create a video decoder. So it's an audio and video player for any format that that GStreamer has installed plugins for. It might also do WMV if I've got it.
Now,
WMV.
This is a perfect demonstration, not just of graphics, but actually of what Cell brings to computer entertainment. Because
three stuff. Okay, so now we have a general purpose video player. We can make that more elaborate. We could add seeking support to it. You send a seek request. You can query it for its current position and provide a slider. You could add a GUI around it. You could make it so that it's adding effects to the pipeline as it creates it. But that's the media players. It gets us to the point that I wanted to be at quite a while ago, which is actually getting started on element stuff. Oh, before I do that. There's a single element that provides all this functionality as well. It's called Playbin. And it is a single element. You tell it a URI, it plays it.